This is the Relic Radio Show, old-time radio entertainment still standing the test of time, from RelicRadio.com.
The Signal Oil Program, The Whistler. That whistle is your signal for the Signal Oil Program, The Whistler.
Whistler, and I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
Yes, friends, it's time for the Signal Oil Program, The Whistler. Independent research rates it the most popular radio program on the Pacific Coast. Remember, let every traffic signal remind you, with Signal, new Signal gasoline, you do go farther than ever. Look for Signal's big yellow and black circle sign that identifies those popular Signal stations in 7 western states from Canada to Mexico. And now, the Whistler's strange story, The Stray Dream.
Chris Claggett was never meant to commit murder. He knew it the minute he did it. But of course it was too late then. The minute it was over and he looked down at Steve Robinson lying there on the floor, he knew that nothing would be the same afterward. That no matter how perfect it was, no matter how thoroughly he outsmarted the police, the big battle was going to take place inside himself, in the middle of his mind. He felt it even stronger 2 hours afterward as he paced the floor of his apartment, waiting for the telephone call that was bound to come sooner or later, trying to read and throwing the magazine aside, mixing drinks and pouring them down the sink, lighting cigarettes he was too nervous to smoke, waiting, waiting. Kathy was bound to call. She had to discover it sooner or later. 2:05 the night before Easter, Steve working late at the florist's shop. But she'd know he couldn't be working that late. She'd go down to see what was keeping him. And then she'd call. Chris was ready for it an hour ago with just the right amount of surprise and shock. But now, at 2:05, he didn't know. The waiting was getting him. And the silence. There it is, Chris.
No, no, wait a minute. Let it ring. Now. Hello?
Chris, this is Kathy.
Oh, Kathy, dear, you know better than to call me at this time.
Chris, listen to me. Something terrible has happened.
Huh? What's the matter?
Steve. Steve is... He's dead, Chris.
What?
He was working late tonight at the flower shop. When he didn't come home, I went down and found him. I just called the police.
Police?
Yes, He's been murdered, Chris.
Good Lord.
Can you come down right away?
Of course. Let me call the night editor first. I'll be right over.
Well, Chris, at least the waiting is over. You carried it off pretty well, didn't you? Just the right amount of surprise and shock. But there's a strange new feeling inside, in the pit of your stomach, something you've never felt before. And the sight of Steve lying where you left him on the floor of the back room of the flower shop, surrounded by banks of Easter lilies and roses. brings the feeling to a dangerous pitch. You're thankful for your training. You don't even have to think as you watch Lieutenant Nelson. You're a police reporter. Your pencil moves automatically, taking down everything you see and hear.
Well, what do you think, Chief?
Probably struck from behind as he was working at this bench.
Yeah, but how did the guy get in?
Didn't have to get in, Gibson. Could have reached in this open window. Oh, Claggett.
Yeah?
You'd better go and file your story. I don't think anything else will break tonight. Just photographs, fingerprint men, and that sort of thing.
All right, Lieutenant.
It's tough, I know. All murders are tough. I think the flowers here are what make this one so horrible. All this beauty and ugliness in the same little room. He was a friend of yours, wasn't he?
Yeah. I'd better go, Lieutenant. What'll I tell Mrs. Robinson?
Tell her I think she's had enough for one night. I'll see her tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
Well, Chris?
It's pretty terrible, Kathy.
What did Lieutenant Nelson say?
You can go now. He'll see you tomorrow afternoon.
Oh.
I gotta file my story. That's something, isn't it? Me filing a story about Steve?
Please, Chris.
I'm sorry. I just...
I know. Chris, I don't know what I'd do if you weren't here.
I'll always be here, Kathy. Remember that, will you?
Sure, Chris. I'll remember.
Just the right balance, Chris. Just enough grief and just enough business as usual. The outside battle is going well, isn't it? Tonight, the reporter, carrying on in spite of everything. Tomorrow, a little less grief, a little more business as usual. At the city editor's desk, for example.
Oh, just a minute, Holloway.
I tell you, I'm right, Chief. The door into the sales room was locked.
You're sure?
Of course I'm sure.
Why?
I remember.
That's the trouble. You think you remember. Where's Chris?
Over there at the counter.
All right, we'll see. Oh, Chris.
Yeah?
Come here a minute. I'll show you what I mean, Holloway.
What's the matter, Chief?
Oh, Holloway here is doing a feature on the murder. He says the door into the sales room was locked. Check it, will you?
Yeah, just a second. Let me see. Oh, here we are. The door had a Yale lock, but it was on the latch and the bolt above it was open.
Yeah, see?
Now, wait a minute. There was a triangular rubber doorstop against it on the workroom side, so it couldn't have been used as an exit. That's it.
See what I mean, Holloway? He doesn't trust his memory. He takes everything down.
Well, that didn't seem very important.
How do you know it's not important? Take it down anyway.
But I was so busy.
So was Chris. Doesn't matter how busy you are. A first-class man makes notes without even thinking about it. Right, Chris?
Yeah, so.
You see, Holloway, that's what I mean by a reporter.
Yes, Chris, you're an expert, a precision machine. Accurate to a millionth of an inch, never wrong on a fact, never guilty of bungling errors like the other reporters. And because you used the same methods to kill Steve Robinson, the outside battle was over before it started. 3 months later, the case is shelved. Kathy's yours, Chris. She's Mrs. Claggett now. You have what you set out to get. Why don't you forget about the battle that's still going on inside?
Chris?
Yeah?
Chris, where are the roses I put on the mantle?
Roses?
Yeah, in the green vase on the mantle, dear.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're kind of wilted. I threw them out.
Wilted? Oh, Chris, I just got them from the florist yesterday.
Why must we always have flowers, Kathy?
Well, because I like
them.
Well,
I don't.
What's the matter, dear? Ever since we got back from our...
I just don't like flowers, Kathy. Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, don't jump at me.
I'm sorry.
What's wrong, Chris? You used to send me flowers before Steve and I...
I know it. You don't have to tell me. It's very simple, Kathy. I don't like flowers because they remind me of Steve.
That's why I want them.
Huh?
They remind me of Steve, too, Chris. I like to think of him once in a while.
Why?
Because I loved him.
Kathy, don't you understand? I was fond of him, too. He was my best friend. But we're not living in the past. Keeping him in front of us all the time isn't going to help.
Well, is that why you objected to living here?
Of course. He's here in the house with us. Everywhere I turn, I see him. Knick-knacks of his all over the place. His picture on your dresser.
Well,
I thought you understood when we were married.
I guess I didn't. Oh, excuse me, Kathy. I'm going to bed.
And so you go to bed, Chris. But you don't sleep for hours. You haven't really slept since the murder, have you? And tonight it's worse than ever. Your mind's like a spinning top. You aren't conscious of the exact moment it begins. But suddenly you find yourself in the press section of a courtroom covering a trial. It's a courtroom different from any you've ever seen. Roses are everywhere. They cover the walls. They flow down over the judge's bench and up the aisles. The scent of them is almost sickening. There's a strange cold feeling inside you as you take in all the details. The judge, the jury, the counsel for the defense and the prosecution. Then your heart almost stops as you realize that the man on trial for murder is you.
Wait a minute. Let me explain. You got me all wrong. No, listen. It's a dream. What am I doing out of bed? Kathy. She heard me. No. Still asleep. Thank heaven.
More coffee, Chris?
No, thanks.
Well, you usually have two cups.
I think I'll cut down a little. I didn't sleep too well last night.
Oh?
Must have been something I ate. You hear me tossing around?
No, I was dead to the world.
I had the feeling when I woke up this morning I've been talking in my sleep. You remember hearing anything?
No. You must have something on your conscience, dear.
Yeah.
Well, that's a relief, isn't it, Chris? It's a good thing Kathy sleeps soundly. You don't remember what you said, but no matter what it was, it would have sounded bad under the circumstances. You feel better that afternoon as you take Kathy downtown for a beauty appointment and get into the swing of things at the office. Then that evening...
Don't you think it might be a good idea to call off our bridge date with the Bartons tonight? You seem so tired.
Yeah, I could use some sleep.
You know, I've been thinking all afternoon about last night.
Huh? What do you mean?
This morning when you asked me, I didn't remember anything unusual, but this afternoon the strangest feeling came.
You mean you heard me?
Heard what?
Well, you remember I was telling you I had some crazy idea. I'd been talking in my sleep.
Well, no, I didn't hear anything.
Oh,
I was just sitting here reading when I suddenly realized I had a funny dream.
Yeah?
Maybe it's because of the roses.
Roses?
Yes, you remember we talked about them before going to bed.
You mean you dreamed about roses?
Well, yes, all mixed up with something about a trial and a courtroom.
Court? Kathy, are you sure?
What? Well, what's the matter, Chris?
Is that all?
Well, that's all I can remember. Chris, what's the matter?
I don't know.
With the prologue of tonight's story, The Stray Dream, Signal brings you another strange story by The Whistler. In place of the message about Signal gasoline, usually heard at this time on The Whistler, Signal Oil Company has asked me to talk with you about something much closer to the heart, about someone you may have forgotten to put on your Christmas list. I'm talking about a serviceman, one who won't be able to be home with his family and friends this Christmas because he's in a hospital, recovering from wounds he suffered, fighting for his country and for you. Can't you imagine the happiness it would bring some serviceman on Christmas morning to receive a gift he wasn't expecting that would tell him, as nothing else could, that he hasn't been forgotten? It needn't be a large gift, but it should be something appropriate, something he could use. And the Red Cross is ready to help you by suggesting the right gift for the right man. Just call the Camp and Hospital Committee of your local Red Cross and tell them you'd like to send a Christmas gift to a serviceman. They'll give you the necessary information. And on Christmas morning, you'll be twice as happy because you'll have brought a ray of happiness to someone who gave so much to give us the best Christmas gift of all, peace. Remember, the place to call is the Camp and Hospital Committee of your local Red Cross. Don't put it off. Call tomorrow, won't you? And now, back to the Whistler.
Chris, for the first time in your life, you're beginning to lose faith in yourself. The shadow of a doubt is slowly making itself felt inside you. You keep telling yourself it must be a coincidence. How else could you and Kathy have had the same dream at the same time? A courtroom filled with roses. Yet she couldn't have pulled that one out of the air. It's too fantastic. It can't be coincidence. Yet what else can it be? Once again, you lie awake for hours trying to find an explanation. And then, just as before, it's all there in front of you, the same courtroom, just as you saw it last night from the press section. You're sitting there just as before, watching the witnesses, listening to statements by the attorneys. But this time, instead of roses, the courtroom is filled with Easter lilies, the same variety you found in the florist shop. Then slowly it melts away, and you lapse into the restful blackness of sleep.
Oh, 7 o'clock. Kathy? Kathy?
Yes, Chris?
Where are you?
I'm in the living room, dear. I'm coming. What's the matter?
When'd you get up?
4 o'clock.
Four? Why?
Oh, I couldn't sleep.
You mean you had another dream?
I don't know what's the matter with me, Chris. It's so real.
Did you have another one? Tell me.
Why, Chris.
I'm sorry. Tell me about it.
It was just like before. The courtroom and the judge, but...
But what?
It wasn't roses this time, Chris. It was Easter lilies.
You want to see me, Chief?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to you for a minute. What's wrong, Chris?
Huh?
What's eating you?
Well, I don't know.
For years I point you out to all the Cubs as a shining example. Everything a star reporter should be. And suddenly your stuff starts coming in so garbled I can't use
well, there's
it.
There's nothing wrong, Chief.
Don't hand me that. I know you too well. Something's eating your heart out and I want to know what it is.
Well, it's none of your business.
It is my business. When the best man on my staff turns in a story on the shakeup at the City Hall full of scrambled references to roses and Easter lilies, you can bet your shirt it's my business.
What was that?
You heard me.
I guess I've just been working too hard.
Is that all?
Yeah, Chief, that's all.
I doubt it. You've been through a lot tougher grinds than this, and I've never seen you fall to pieces yet. What's the matter, Chris? You look like a ghost.
I told you that there's nothing the matter. I just need a rest.
All right, then, take one. A long one.
How long?
As long as you want, on full salary. And don't come back until you can write a straight story.
Holloway?
Yeah, Chris.
Holloway, didn't you do a story once on a professor over at the university? Something about experiments on extrasensory perception or thought transference or something?
Yeah. His name was Duncan, I think.
What did he do? What was it all about?
I don't remember very well. I think they'd line up a batch of students at one end of a room and have them concentrate on numbers. Yeah, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then another group would try and write the numbers down.
What's his name again?
Duncan. Charles Duncan.
I really don't like to appear too definite on this, Mr. Claggett. Nothing has been proved conclusively.
You mean there's no such thing as thought transference, Professor Duncan?
It's hard to say. It's a very unscientific attitude to take. assuming that two minds are in tune, so to speak. But we have found rare cases in which there seems to be no other conclusion.
I see. Does distance seem to make any difference?
Oh, yes, I would say it cuts down the possibilities considerably.
Uh-huh. Thanks, Professor.
That's the only way you can explain it, isn't it, Chris? You and Kathy must be one of the rare cases the professor talked about. There's no other answer. It's maddening to have carried it off so perfectly, to have won the outside battle so completely, only to lose your grip on the secret while you're asleep and the bars are down. And there's only one defense, isn't there, Chris? He said that distance did make a difference.
Hello, darling.
Chris, what in the world are you doing home so early?
Oh, I had a talk with Jones. He says I need a rest.
Well, he's right.
So how would you like to go away for a couple of weeks?
Where?
Oh, Tahoe, maybe.
Why, I think that's a wonderful idea, Chris.
Could you be ready this afternoon?
Well, I don't know. It's a rush order.
Oh, there wouldn't be much packing. We'd just knock around our old clothes.
Well, I'll try.
Great. Great, I knew you would.
What about you?
Well, I was about to tell you, I'll have to join you later. There's some things I got to clear up, you know.
Well, why can't I wait? We could go up together.
Now, don't be that way, darling. I want you to have it all ready for me when I arrive. I'll get your reservations on the 3 o'clock train. How about it?
Well, all right, Chris.
Great. Well, gee, look at the time. We got to hurry. Come on, I'll help you.
Well, Chris, she's out of the way for the time being. You're relieved for the moment. But the old tension returns that night as you lie down to sleep in Steve's house among Steve's things. She's at Lake Tahoe, Chris, 250 miles away. You keep telling yourself that distance will make the difference, just as the professor said. You try not to think of it as you lie there. Try to make your mind a blank. But the same impressions come back again and again. He's there, Chris. Steve is there in the courtroom with the flowers all around him. You sit in the press section, you can't take your eyes off him. He's smiling at you, Chris, as he gets slowly out of his seat and walks toward the witness stand, stepping carefully over the rows of roses and Easter lilies. He's going to talk, Chris. You realize there's no other way out now. Then you find yourself on your feet, shouting your lungs out, telling the court you killed him.
I killed him! I admit it! I can't stand this any longer. I killed him. Because I loved his wife, I thought I'd be happy, but I was wrong. I don't care anymore. I don't care. Good Lord. Oh, good Lord.
Martin's Cove, Lake Tahoe.
Hello, this is Christopher Claggett. I'd like to speak to Mrs. Claggett, please.
Just a moment.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, sir. She doesn't answer.
All right, I'll call back.
She doesn't answer, Mr. Claggett. I'll tell her you called.
Hello? Hello, Kathy.
Hello, Chris.
Where have you been, Kathy? I've been calling you since 8 this morning. It's 4 o'clock.
I know it.
Why didn't you answer?
I couldn't. I was so upset by... Chris. Chris, I had the dream again. It was awful.
You're lying.
No, Chris,
no. It's impossible. You couldn't have.
It was your trial, Chris. Steve was there testifying.
Stop it, Kathy.
I tell you, Chris, it was real. I could swear I was right there in the courtroom.
I said stop it. Listen, Kathy, listen to me. You've got to let me explain. Don't do anything. Don't... see anybody. I'll be on the next train. It leaves Berkeley in an hour.
There's only one way out now, Chris. It's you or Kathy. You did it once and got away with it. You're wondering now whether you can do it again. But there's no alternative, is there? It's you... or Kathy. That's why, at 5 minutes past midnight, you're at Martin's Cove walking through the darkness behind the row of hotel cabins, You know Kathy's in number 16, and at this hour she'll be sleeping. You keep well in the shadows of the trees at the edge of the cabin area. 14. 15. 16, this is the one. The window's open. You can see her head on the pillow. You pull out your revolver. You wish there were some other way, but there isn't. Just a moment now.
Hey! What are you...
Drop that gun!
I got him! Let me go!
I said drop that gun! All right, Claggett.
Nelson!
You can come along peacefully, or you can come feet first. At the moment, I'm not particular.
The Whistler will return in just a moment with the strange ending of tonight's story. Meantime, here's an interesting feature about the new 1946 cars. One of the leading sixes advertises 25 to 30 miles per gallon. And throughout the field, auto manufacturers are stressing increased mileage. This is being done not just as a matter of economy, but because mileage is the result of better performance, a proof of greater efficiency. Well, as you know, Signal gasoline has long been famous as the go-farther gasoline. But here's the important point. Signal Oil Company, always quick to give the motoring public the advantage of new trends, new improvements, has actually engineered new Signal gasoline to help you go farther than ever. How Signal did it involves a long scientific explanation about rearranging the atoms in gasoline molecules to give amazing new power to new Signal gasoline. The immediate noticeable results of this new power are quicker starting, faster pickup, and higher anti-knock. But because this increased power means you'll be shifting less, and shifting is the demon that wastes gasoline, your speedometer will prove to you that it's a fact. You do go farther than ever with new Signal gasoline. And now, back to the Whistler.
So you finally lost the inside battle, didn't you, Chris? There in the shadows with Gibson pinning your arms to your sides and Lieutenant Nelson standing in front of you with a gun in his hand, you realize it's all over. You had the feeling from the first, didn't you? From the moment you killed Steve Robinson in the rear of his flower shop, you knew it was a losing battle. But it was too late to change anything.
You should have known that it wouldn't go, Chris.
How did you know?
Your wife called us.
Thought so.
Not until you confessed, of course.
Confessed?
Yes, all written out pretty as you please. 10 pages of it in your own handwriting. Garbled up with a lot of nonsense about roses and Easter lilies.
What are you talking about?
You didn't really think that you and your wife were dreaming the same dream, did you? Well, my error. You must have, or you wouldn't have tried to kill her. She wasn't asleep on that first night, Chris. She watched you get out of bed, take one of your spare notebooks out of the dresser drawer.
I was writing. It was real.
Well, the writing was real, at least. You almost had a stump, though, when you sent her up here. We had to wait 3 hours until you went out for lunch to get into your house and find the notebook. She couldn't answer you when you called, of course, until we got to her by telephone and told her what she had dreamed last night.
Well, that's it, isn't it?
You were too good a reporter, Chris. A guy who can take notes without thinking should never take a crack at murder. Especially if he walks in his sleep.
At 9 o'clock, the Whistler will bring you another strange tale. The Whistler is broadcast for your entertainment by the marketers of Signal gasoline and motor oil and fine quality automotive accessories, and by your neighborhood Signal dealer. This program produced by George W. Allen, with tonight's story by Harold Swanton, music by Wilbur Hatch, is transmitted to our troops overseas by the Armed Forces Radio Service. That whistle is your signal for the Signal Oil program, The Whistler. This is Marvin Miller speaking, reminding you to look for those familiar yellow and black circle signs that identify those popular Signal Oil stations in 7 western states from Canada to Mexico. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Diary of Fate. Fate plays no favorites. It could happen to you.
Book 84, page 946.
In the Diary of Fate.
Yes, here it is. The name Albert Riker. Occupation, department foreman with a construction company. Once, Albert, you were a man of skill and intelligence. But that was before you were subjugated to the insidious will of Eugene Margot, a vicious man whose promises of easy riches through gambling engulfed first your judgment, then your confidence, and finally, even your sense of honesty. In a desperate but futile effort to recover your losses, you risked much more money. Money that was not your own. And now today, Albert, because of a little thing, because you forgot your car keys, your life will be destroyed. In a moment when I have written, I will read from the record of Albert Riker in The Diary of Fate. Life record of Albert Riker, the stamp of doom is already fixed on the pages of his future. And for a brief moment, I, Fate, look ahead at a single awful incident.
What's the matter, Nancy?
Albert, why are you looking at me like that? Albert, I'm frightened.
Of your own sentimental husband in an old blue sport coat? With a silly checkered weave?
Albert, what are you going to do? Stay away from me! Albert!
In the life of Albert Riker, the decision to murder was made. Then I, Fate, again employed the small, seemingly insignificant things that determined the inevitable outcome. It is ever thus. A turn down the wrong street. A misaddressed envelope. A broken shoelace. Little things, yes. But these are the tools with which I, Fate, shape your destiny. Remember, Albert Riker, how it all started? It was evening. You were about to leave the office when your employer stopped you. Mr. Bradley's voice was firm and cold.
Oh, Albert, I'd like to talk to you a moment.
If it's about that Nadella deal, sir,
I... No, Albert, something else. Something more personal.
Something personal? My work, Mr. Bradley?
Yes. Until quite recently, you've always been so thorough, meticulous, and honest. That's why I haven't called the police.
The police? What? What do you mean, Mr. Bradley?
The Clark account.
Clark? I don't understand.
I think you do, Albert. On the 11th of this month, Dana Clark deposited $9,000 with you. But it didn't show up on your books. Now, where is that money? Answer me, where is it?
I took it, Mr. Bradley.
Why, Albert, why?
What difference does it make? I said I took
it. You young fool, it makes all the difference in the world. Is it family trouble? Your wife, sickness? Don't you understand? If your reason is good enough, I might help you to not turn you over to the police.
Yes, Albert. The money you had lost gambling with Margot and his friends has belonged to Mr. Bradley. But as you faced him and brazenly lied about a family mortgage, which had prompted you to borrow from the firm, you thought bitterly of the $20,000 in negotiable securities your wife Nancy kept hidden at home. Mr. Bradley accepted your desperate promise to return the money within a week. And when you arrived home, the thought of the bonds Nancy owned had crowded everything else from your mind.
Nancy, for the love of heaven, listen to me. You've got to do as I say. You must give me those bonds.
I don't have to do anything of the kind. Now, look, Albert, we've been through all this before. I don't want to lose every penny I have because someone has a better poker hand than you do.
I said it was for an investment, a good investment.
And I say you're lying. Albert, I just can't trust you anymore. You're gambling. I never know what you are or who you're with.
Oh, good Lord, must you also be the jealous wife?
Well, what do you expect?
Oh, Nancy, you're not making sense. Now, look, I've got to have those bonds. I'm in debt.
What about your late hours and those women?
Nancy, there are no other women.
You're lying. Oh, it's useless to talk to you. I'm going to bed. And don't bother trying to find the bonds, Elvis. I have a new place to hide things from my husband. Good night.
Oh, who the devil? Hello.
Riker, this is Mark.
You realize it's after midnight? I told you not to call me at home.
You told me. Look, sonny, don't step out, please. I'm still the teacher and it's still only 4 grand. I get impatient over Mark.
I know it, Margot. Give me a little time. I'll work everything out.
Sure you will, Albert. Sure. I wanted to let you know I'll be at the Crater Hotel for tomorrow night on.
The Crater Hotel?
That's right. I'll expect to see you there. So long.
Goodbye, Margot. Well, Nancy, what are you doing out of bed?
Who are you talking to?
Oh, just the fellow I know. He was,
Don't you think I have ears? Go ahead, lie to me. Keep on lying.
What are you talking about? Have you lost your mind?
Not yet, I haven't. And believe me, until I do, you'll never see those bonds.
Margo, I've only got 5 days left. 5 days to make up $9,000.
Correction, Riker, $13,000. You owe me 4 grand.
Well, that's just it. If I don't pay Bradley the money I took, I'll be sent to jail.
That's your problem.
That'll cost you $4,000. Wages are low in prison.
Easy, fella. Don't get clever with me. If I don't get my money, you may never get as far as prison. Now, don't forget that.
What do you mean?
Business is business, right? I'm not interested in weaklings who fold up and cry for favors when the going gets a little rough.
Well, don't worry. I'm not folding up. I'll get out of this hole, and I'll pay you, too.
Well, now you're talking. Just don't let it stop there with talking. I get kind of tired of that.
Yes, Albert. Eugene Margot was ruthless. Money was the only thing that could speak for you now. So you decided as a last resort to appeal again to the generosity of Mr. Bradley.
And what was it you wanted to see me about this morning, Albert?
Well, I wanted to thank you, Mr. Bradley, for this chance to clear myself.
And I don't think you'll ever slip again, Albert.
Oh, you can depend on that, Mr. Bradley. And just as soon as I've paid you the money, why, I'll feel like a new man.
And I'm glad you see it that way. By next week, we'll both be able to forget it ever happened.
Well, that's what I wanted to see you about, Mr. Bradley. Could you possibly stretch that time limit? A couple of months would make it a lot easier for me.
Now, I'll get out here at the corner.
Yes, sir. Well, about the money, Mr. Bradley.
I heard you, Albert. I've made it extremely easy for you already. So remember this. If I don't have that money in cash in 4 days, I'll have to call in the police. Do I make myself quite clear?
Bradley's words swept through you like an icy wind. And for the first time, you were afraid. Trapped between the hard ruthlessness of the underworld and the equally unyielding impartiality of the law, you had no one to turn to now but Nancy, your wife. One way or another, you had to have those bonds.
Well, now that you've turned the house into a shambles, are you satisfied that I've got a good hiding place?
Sooner or later, Nancy, I'll find those bonds.
What good will that do you? If you try to cash them, I'll tell the police you stole them from me.
Why, you wouldn't dare.
Albert, let me go. I risk you're hurting me.
What do you think you're doing to me? It's not pleasant when a man's own wife won't stand behind him when he's in trouble.
You can save the teachers. Save them for your girlfriend. Or doesn't she have any bonds?
Oh, you blind fool, Nancy. I've told you 100 times there isn't anybody else.
Oh,
what's the use?
Albert, where are you going?
Out. Any place away from you.
You stormed out of the house and walked quickly to your car. Then, Albert, fate intervened, and a little thing happened. You forgot your car key. You turned back toward the house, then stopped abruptly. The shades were drawn, and Nancy's silhouette stood out sharply in the light from the living room table lamp. Suddenly, you had the answer. The lamp was being tilted. Now you knew where the bonds were hidden, in the base of the table lamp. You turned and walked slowly down the street, your mind busy with the birth of evil thoughts. But Nancy, too, was upset. And later, as you neared a decision for murder, she entered the lobby of a downtown hotel she had heard you mention over the telephone. The Crater Hotel. Then another little thing happened. Because she stopped to buy cigarettes, she overheard a conversation a man was having at an open telephone booth nearby.
Well, dear friend, I could certainly not move. Martin, Eugene Martin, say that. That's right, Pilot. Okay.
Pardon me. Are you Margot, Mr. Margot?
That's right, lady. Eugene Margot's the name. Don't believe we've ever met.
No, we haven't. I'm a friend of Albert Riker. Do you know him?
Yeah, I know Riker.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. I'm very glad.
Yes, Albert. Because of a little thing, your wife had discovered that Margot was a man. And as that single fact relieved her mind of the gnawing suspicion that you were unfaithful, she resolved to help you. But you had given up all hope of any voluntary help from Nancy, and you could no longer afford to wait. You called Margot.
Listen, Margot, I may need you as an alibi soon. I'll have to be able to prove I was at your place.
That can be arranged for a price.
Well, I can pay $1,000.
Make it two and it's a deal.
All right, it's a deal. I'll let you know the details later.
Yes, Albert. Now you face the decision. Your freedom or Nancy's life. But there was no doubt in your mind. You had no love for your wife. And now it was too late to turn back. Soon I will record another entry in the Diary of Fate. Faced with decision today, can choose for evil and be certain of tomorrow. And even as you, Albert Riker, took the first step in your plan of murder, that of winning back Nancy's confidence, other forces were gathering against you.
Is that you, Albert?
Yes, Nancy. I got off early, all right.
Well, you know, since your wonderful phone call this afternoon, it seems like time has just been standing still. What's that?
Oh, this. Some flowers. Violets. I remembered you liked them once, Nancy.
Oh, they're lovely, Albert. Oh, darling. How did we ever let things get so far out of hand?
Oh, it's been all my fault. Everything went wrong, and, well, I just took it out on you. Believe me, Nancy, I'm sorry, too. Very sorry.
The thing goes to me, but let's not talk about what happened. Let's try to start over again.
That's exactly what I have in mind. Nancy, do you remember where we did start?
The lake, our honeymoon. Oh, Albert, wouldn't it be wonderful? Could we go there again, just the two of us?
We're going to, Nancy. I've already planned every detail. We're going day after tomorrow.
Oh, darling. Oh, wonderful. I remember it all so plainly. That cozy little cabin, the fireplace, and you and that sport coat I was so crazy about.
Not the blue one.
Yes, the blue one with the funny little check running through it. Albert, will you wear it?
Oh, but Nancy.
Please,
it's...
Albert, please. Promise me.
Well, all right. I'll wear it.
Yes, Albert. Nancy's enthusiasm for the trip you had planned so carefully gave you confidence when you spoke to Mr. Bradley the next morning.
I wanted to tell you, Mr. Bradley, that I've worked things out and I'll have the money by tomorrow night.
But that's splendid, Albert.
I'll never let you down again, Mr. Bradley. You and my wife have complete faith in me. It's given me strength.
You told your wife?
Oh, yes, sir. You see, it was sort of to help Nancy's folks that I took the money. So I'll have the cash for you by tomorrow night at the latest. Another drink, Nancy?
No, thanks, darling. Albert, about that trouble we had with the bonds and...
Oh, let's forget about that, Nancy.
There'll be plenty of time to talk.
That's right, and... Oh, speaking of the cabin, I forgot to tell you that I won't be able to come up until late tomorrow afternoon.
Look, darling, I've been looking forward to it so much.
Well, look, you go up at noon as we planned, and I'll be there in time for dinner.
But, darling, why do you have to stay in town so late tomorrow?
Well, it's something at the office, Nancy.
All right. I'll be ready and waiting. So no stops on the way. Come right up to the office.
Don't worry, Nancy. I'll be there.
Yes, Albert, you would be there. You were impatient the next morning, and it was impossible for you to work as you thought ahead to the moment when your wife would be out of the way, and you would have the money you needed so desperately. Finally, it was time to leave the office. You were almost to the door when...
Albert, Mr. Winters is on the phone now, and he wants to see the specifications on their plant addition at once. They've got some sort of conference going on up at his office. I hope you don't mind going up there now.
Why,
Why, no, Mr. Bradley. Not at all.
Good. It shouldn't take more than an hour or so. And, I'll meet you at your place tonight about that other matter. Will 9 o'clock be all right?
Yes, Mr. Bradley. That'll be fine.
Little thing, Albert. Yes. I, fate, brought about an interruption in your timetable for murder. The conference with Mr. Winters took even longer than you had anticipated. And when you left his office, it was too late to return to your house and get the bond. You decided to drive directly to the cabin. For any moment now, Nancy might get worried and start making telephone calls. In less than an hour, you were close to the lake. Only minutes from murder. As you got out of the car and walked up the path, your eye caught the blue sport jacket draped over the banister of the cabin porch where Nancy had hung it, so you couldn't miss seeing it. You laughed bitterly as you thought of your promise to Nancy. And you quickly removed your coat and put on the blue sport jacket. Then you went in.
Good evening, Nancy.
Oh, hello, darling. I was just beginning to worry about... Oh, Albert, the sport coat. How sweet. I knew you'd wear it. I was sure.
Oh, were you?
Of course. Now, Olivia, look at you. Oh, the memories it brings back. You know, it's just...
What's the matter, Nancy?
Albert, why are you looking at me like that? Albert, I'm frightened.
Of your own sentimental husband in an old blue sport coat with a silly checkered weave?
Albert, what are you going to do? Stay away from me!
Yes, Albert Riker, you killed your wife. For a moment, you stared transfixed at her blood on your jacket. The blue jacket that she had wanted you to wear. Then you moved quickly. You threw the blood-stained jacket over your wife, struck a match to a newspaper, and threw it into the center of the room. At the door, you stopped, picked up the kerosene lamp, and hurled it at the opposite wall where it smashed to bits. As you stepped from the cabin, you heard the awful engulfing sound of the flames as they reached the spattered kerosene. Yes, your scheme of murder was completed. Soon you would have the bond you needed so badly. Soon you would have nothing to fear from Bradley or Margot. And now, lest any who listen think that I, fate, am unmindful of the inevitable balance of the scales of justice, I urge you to listen closely, for in a few moments, I will make the final entry under the name of Albert Riker in The Diary of Fate. Constant as the passing of time is the unrelenting principle of justice. Yes, Albert Riker, even as you arrived at your house an hour after you had murdered your wife, the plan already set in motion by your decision for evil was quickly moving to its irrevocable conclusion. And not even I, fate, could alter its inevitable course. For only seconds after you entered the living room, your doorbell rang. It was Mr. Bradley.
I'm sorry I'm a bit late, Albert, but I have a mountain of work at the office. If you don't mind, I'll take the money and leave it for you.
Well, Mr. Bradley, the truth of the matter is that I haven't got it yet.
What? Listen right here. Don't ever mistake my generosity for stupidity.
Oh, it's not that, sir. You see, I've got it in bonds, negotiable ones. I just didn't get to the bank yesterday, and what with the winter's deal this afternoon, and then the...
All right, Albert, all right. I'll take the bonds. I can straighten everything out on Monday.
Well, that suits me, Mr. Bradley. I've got them right here in this lamp bait. Sort of a family vault. Well, here we are. We'll have the bonds in a second, and then I can go...
Well, what's wrong, Wright?
The bonds. They're gone.
What? They're gone, I tell you. What's that?
That's the bus. Why, it's a note.
Give it to me. It's from your wife. Let's see. Dear Albus, I hope you never find this letter, for if you do, it can only mean that you never intended to meet me at the lake. It can only mean that you intended to rob me. If that was your plan, Albert, I'm sorry, because I've already converted the bonds into cash, and I intended to give you the money. You see, I was wrong about Margot. I thought Margot was a woman. Yes, Albert, if you were really sincere about our starting all over again, the money is yours. I put it in the inside pocket of your blue sport jacket. The one...
What? The blue jacket. That's funny. All of it was in the blue jacket.
Where is it?
The jacket. But I burned it in the cabin. Don't you understand? I destroyed it. I threw it over Nancy and set it on fire.
And now it is time to close the book. Another entry has been duly noted. In the case of Albert Riker, as in the cases of all mortals, I, fate, am but the instrument of a plan. And the little things of life are the tools with which I work. I, fate, arranged for Albert Riker to forget his car keys. And as a result, he discovered where his wife had hidden the bond. And because of another little thing, because Nancy Riker remembered a blue jacket, Albert's evil scheme exploded. And in the hysteria of the moment, he admitted setting fire to the cabin, and the entire plan was revealed. And now, Eugene Margot sits in his prison cell, paying his debt to society. And as Albert Riker feels the straps of the electric chair snapped about his legs, he curses me, fate, for the little things that brought about his undoing. Now the plan is finished, complete, and justice has been served. Ponder well the moral, you who listen, and remember, there is a page for you in The Diary of Fate.
The cast included Herbert Litton, Gloria Blondell, Frank Albertson, Howard McNear, Ray Erlenborn, Bert Horswell, Ivan Ditmars, and Hal Sawyer. This is a Larry Finley transcription. Brought to you from Hollywood.